Chapter 20. Discussions in Bombay and Deolali. The name of Ajanta was not new to me. I had been familiar with it from my boyhood. Ever since the discovery of Mukul Chandra Day's, my journeys to Ajanta and Bagh had given me my first real glimpse of the colourful and inspiring world of Buddhist art. From the pages of the book had looked out some of the divinest faces and forms ever conceived by the heart or executed by the hand of man. The faces and forms depicted on the walls, ceilings and pillars of the cave temples of Ajanta. There was the Buddha sitting in the attitude of teaching the Dharma, his head aureoled as though by the outraying petals of a giant chrysanthemum, and the Buddha standing calm and majestic, arms bowl in hand, looking down at the diminutive figures of Yashodhara, his former wife, and Rahula, the child of his humanity. There were flying figures. There were celestial maidens with wonderful coiffures. There were tiaraed bodhisattvas with blue lotuses in their hands. There were palace scenes. There were wild geese with entwined necks. There were elephants and lotus flowers. During the 8 years that I had lived in India, I had seen these same faces and forms many times, for reproductions of the Ajanta wall paintings, often featured in books on Buddhism and on Indian art. And as a result of this, some of the faces and some of the forms that I had first seen looking out from the pages of my journeys to Ajanta and Bagh were now deeply imprinted on my consciousness. As yet, however, I had not actually visited Ajanta or seen its paintings with my own eyes, and in fact was not to do so for quite a few more years. Raj Kapoor had visited Ajanta only a few weeks before attending the Sanchi celebrations, and had been so overwhelmed by the experience that, as Rask told me on the train, for several days afterwards he had been able to talk of nothing else. Ajanta had in fact become something of an obsession with him, and as was usually the case with his obsessions, apparently, he wanted to turn it into a film, with himself in the leading role. But before he could do this, however, there was another film to be finished and many questions about Ajanta that he wanted to ask. One of these questions in particular must have been very much on his mind, for on the occasion of our first meeting in Bombay, he lost no time in putting it to me. It was generally understood, he prefaced, that the wall paintings of Ajanta had been executed by Buddhist monks, but some of those paintings were of an undeniably erotic character. They represented physically attractive young women in a state of almost complete nudity. How, then, was it possible for the monks who had executed those paintings to have been free from sexual desire? I had not considered this question before, and consequently had to think fast. Or rather, I did not think at all. The answer sprang to my lips as quickly and as spontaneously as though I had been inspired by the goddess Sarasvati herself, the veena-playing patroness of learning and eloquence. To the monk artists of Ajanta, women were simply part of the natural world, I replied. They depicted them in the same spirit that they depicted flowers, fruits, creepers, birds, animals, and other natural objects. They depicted them with sympathy, but at the same time with complete detachment. And it was for precisely this reason that the women of the Ajanta wall paintings were so divinely beautiful. In other words, the ancient monk artists perceived women in purely aesthetic terms, and they were able to perceive them in purely aesthetic terms on account of their complete freedom from sexual desire. Had they not been free from sexual desire, they could not possibly have depicted the women on the Ajanta wall paintings in the way they had done, and the paintings would really have been of an erotic character. Unpremeditated though my reply to Raj Kapoor's question was, the more I afterwards thought about it, the more convinced I became that the explanation I had given him was correct, and that, whether monks or laymen, the artists of Ajanta must have been free from sexual desire. Correct or not, the explanation appeared to satisfy Raj Kapoor, who proceeded to hold forth on the topic of Ajanta at great length and with the utmost enthusiasm. It was by no means always clear, however, whether he was referring to Ajanta the place or to Ajanta the film, or even to both of them simultaneously. What gradually did become clear, though, was that Ajanta the film was at an even earlier stage of production than I had imagined. Indeed, it could hardly have been in a more embryonic condition, being little more than the gleam in Raj Kapoor's eyes and the stream of words that flowed from his lips. From what he then told me, and Rask, who obviously had heard it all before, I gathered that during his visit to Ajanta, it was as though the centuries had rolled away like clouds, and he was standing not in the cave temples as they were today, but in the cave temples as they had been in the days of their pristine glory. Moreover, he was wearing yellow robes. He was a young monk, perhaps a novice. Not that he had suddenly remembered being a young monk at Ajanta in a previous existence, he assured me, though the possibility could not be ruled out. Did Buddhists believe in rebirth like the Hindus? Yes, he thought that they did. It was simply that he had felt what it must have been like to be a young monk at Ajanta all those hundreds of years ago. Perhaps the young monk was one of the artists who had decorated the walls of the cave temples. Perhaps he had executed some of the very paintings about which he had asked me at the beginning of our conversation, the paintings of physically attractive young women in a state of almost complete nudity. No doubt the monk artists who had executed the paintings were, in fact, completely free from sexual desire, as I had so clearly explained. But perhaps in the case of this young monk, just this young monk, there had been a little bit of sexual desire still remaining, and perhaps the women he had depicted on the walls of the cave temples were, in a way, the expression of that desire. Perhaps he had even fallen in love with the most beautiful of his own creations, or with one of the slave girls who waited on the monks and who had been secretly in love with him all the time. Where Raj Kapoor had got the idea that the monks of Ajanta had slave girls to wait on them, I did not know. Perhaps the young monk and the slave girl had run away together. Perhaps the young monk wanted to experience the world. He had become a monk while still only a boy. He had been left an orphan at an early age and had been adopted by the head monk of Ajanta, a wise old man who loved him dearly. In the end, having experienced the world to the full, the young monk returns to Ajanta. The old monk, now very old indeed, clasps him to his breast. He is his best and truest disciple, he declares. He alone has understood his teaching. He alone has understood that truth is to be found not by rejecting the world, but by experiencing it. After the old monk's death, the young monk, now not so young as he was, becomes the head monk of Ajanta, while the slave girl becomes his faithful disciple. Together they tread the path to enlightenment. By this time, the gleam in Raj Kapoor's eyes had become brighter, and the words were flowing from his lips in a more rapid stream. It was as though he could actually see the concluding scenes of the film, could see the young monk returning to Ajanta, see the old monk clasping the young monk to his breast, see the young monk becoming the head monk of Ajanta, and finally, see the young monk and the slave girl, the hero and the heroine, himself and his leading lady, slowly walking hand in hand into the sunset to the accompaniment of appropriate music. From time to time, in his excitement, he rose to his feet and not only supplemented the stream of words with extravagant gestures, but even impersonated, one after another, the different characters whose experience he was describing. In my naivety, I imagined that Ajanta now had a story, and wondered why Rashk was not writing it all down, or at least making a few notes. But Rashk knew better. He had heard several versions of the story of Ajanta already, and in fact he and I were to hear several more versions of it in the next few days. In one of these later versions, the young monk falls in love not with a slave girl, but with a beautiful princess who has come to Ajanta on pilgrimage, or to pray for her sick father's restoration to health. Raj Kapoor could not make up his mind which. He marries her, becomes king when her father dies, and returns to Ajanta only at the very end of his life. In another, he is not an artist, but a physician, and marries the princess after curing her father of a serious illness, and so on. Eventually, I realised that all the different versions of the story had certain features in common. They all began in Ajanta and ended in Ajanta, and they all featured a young monk who, having fallen in love and experienced the world, returns to the peace and seclusion of the cave temples where he has been brought up. I also realised that Raj Kapoor was in fact not interested in giving the story of Ajanta a definite form. That would come later. What he was really doing, as he fantasised about what it must have been like to be a young monk at Ajanta in the days of its glory, was feeling his way into the film, especially into the role of the young monk, as well as trying to create the kind of scenes and situations that would enable him to exhibit his particular talents as an actor to their greatest possible advantage. Even when relating what was, for me, the first version of the story of Ajanta, Raj Kapoor portrayed the young monk so convincingly that it was evident that he had been feeling his way into the role for some time and was, in fact, quite strongly identified with it already. But what was the young monk's name? It was as though, being now quite strongly identified with the part, Raj Kapoor wanted to know what the young monk was called, wanted to know what he was called. The rest of our first meeting in Bombay was therefore spent trying to decide upon a name for the hero of Ajanta, or, as Raj Kapoor saw it, trying to discover what the young monk's name actually was. For an hour or more, I ransacked my memory for suitable names from the scriptures and from Buddhist history and legend. One after another, I brought the names up, and one after another, Raj Kapoor tried them out, so to speak, by repeating them aloud a number of times. Ananda, Aniruddha, Mahanama, Tissa, Kashyapa, Ashoka, Upagupta, all were tried and rejected. Eventually, I produced the name of Purna. This time, Raj Kapoor not only repeated the name, but repeated it with increasing satisfaction and delight. Purna, he breathed as his eyes shone and his whole face lit up. Yes, that was his name. Purna. Purna. So extremely delighted was he with the name, and to such an extent did he seem to take it for his own, that I would hardly have been surprised if he had announced that in future he was to be called not Raj Kapoor, but Purna. Had he actually done so, Rashk would not have been impressed, even if I had been. In 15 minutes' time, the swarthy young script writer observed as we drove off together afterwards, Raj Kapoor would be back on the set and immersed in a totally different role. True that this may have been, from the cordiality of the film star's au revoirs, it was clear that, so far as he was concerned, our first meeting in Bombay had been a complete success, and that in finding a name for the hero of Ajanta, we had, in fact, done a good day's work. the scene of this first meeting, as of most of my subsequent meetings with Raj Kapoor, was the lounge of his private quarters on the ground floor of RK Studios, immediately adjoining the production area. On our arrival in Bombay, Rashk had booked me into a first-class hotel, as previously instructed, and it was he who, a day or two later, drove me from the hotel to the studios for my meeting with Raj Kapoor, a service he was to perform several more times before the week was out. At the end of the week, however, I moved from the hotel to Ananda Vihara, the bigger and more centrally situated of the Mahabodhi Society's Bombay centres, which at that time was without a resident bhikshu, and in fact almost empty. It was not that the hotel was uncomfortable. If anything, it was rather too comfortable, and on the principle that a monk out of his cloister is like a fish out of water, I thought it better for me to stay at Ananda Vihara, especially as there was plenty of room there, and as, moreover, I would be more accessible to anyone who wanted to see me. Henceforth, it was not from the hotel, but from Ananda Vihara that Rashk drove me to my meetings with Raj Kapoor, usually stopping on the way so that we could have a cup of tea and a chat. On our approaching the RK Studios building, which was situated in Chembur, one of the more outlying parts of Bombay, I would invariably see a dozen or more young men hanging about the compound gate. They were all would-be film stars, Rashk explained as he drove me through for the first time. They were all hoping to see Raj Kapoor and, if possible, persuade him to give them an audience. There was not one of them who would not sell his own grandmother for the sake of 5 minutes with the great man. Some of them could sing, some could dance, some were merely good-looking. Probably not one of them could act, but they all wanted to be rich and famous, and they all believed, not without reason, that for a poor boy without connections or qualifications, there was one road, and one road only, to riches and fame, and that was the films. Since our meetings were always arranged in advance, on my arrival at the studios, I usually found Raj Kapoor in his private quarters waiting for me. Sometimes, however, he was still acting or directing or both, in which case Rashk and I would make ourselves comfortable in the lounge until 15 or 20 minutes later he came to us straight from the set with his makeup on and with profuse apologies for his unpunctuality. That last scene had proved unexpectedly difficult, and it had taken them a long time to get it right. On such occasions he looked very tired and drawn, but at the same time bright underneath, and clearly ready to get back to Ajanta and back into the role of Purna without further delay. As soon as he had washed and changed, therefore, the meeting would begin. At all other times it began as soon as Rashk and I had arrived, sometimes even before the three of us were fairly seated round the coffee table in the centre of the room. Several meetings were devoted to Buddhist monastic life, for I was concerned that this should be correctly represented in the film, and that so long as the young monk wore the yellow robe, there should be no love scenes between him and the slave girl or the beautiful princess, or whoever else it had been decided the heroine should be. According to the Buddhist monastic law, I explained, a bhikshu could not come into physical contact with a woman, or sit alone with her in a secluded place, or laugh and joke with her. And if Purna was shown doing any of these things while still a monk, many Buddhists would feel deeply shocked, protests would be made to the government of India, and in some Buddhist countries the film might even be banned. I also demonstrated the way in which Buddhist monks chanted such things as the refuges and precepts and the salutation to the three jewels, at the same time suggesting that if any of the scenes in the cave temples called for congregational chanting, it might be a good idea to enlist the cooperation of Venerable Sangharatana and the other monks of Sarnath, though in the interests of authenticity, they would have to chant in Sanskrit and not, as they usually did, in Pali. To this and other suggestions of mine, Raj Kapoor listened attentively, with head bowed and hands clasped between his knees, only occasionally looking up to interpose a comment or question, or to take up something I had said and make it the starting point for one of his own fantasizings. On the whole, he found my suggestions acceptable enough, though he was not very happy with the idea of having to shave his head for those scenes in which Purna appeared as a monk. At least, he was not very happy with it until Rashk pointed out that it would not be difficult for the makeup man to provide him with an artificial scalp that would fit over his hair. With the idea that some of the scenes in the cave temples might call for congregational chanting, however, he was very happy indeed. On his visit to Ajanta, he had, it seemed, been greatly impressed by the main Chatiya Hall, with its two rows of pillars and its stoop at the far end, and had no difficulty imagining it filled with yellow-robed figures, all chanting together, with Purna in their midst. Whether the scene was to take place before Purna ran away with the slave girl or the beautiful princess, or whether it was to take place when he became the head monk of Ajanta, or when he returned to Ajanta at the very end of his life, was not very clear, but so vividly did Raj Kapoor describe the scene that, as he spoke, I saw the lamps shining on the lined faces of the monks and heard the sound of the chanting as, filling the hall with more and more powerful vibrations, it gradually rose to its tremendous climax. In the course of our discussions, Raj Kapoor, Rask and I would usually be joined by one or more members of Raj Kapoor's inner circle, as it might be termed. Besides the more shadowy figures of the arts director and the music director, this included Shankar and Jai Kishan and Miss Nargis. Shankar and Jai Kishan were two very unassuming young men of very ordinary appearance, who were always seen together, and who never said anything, unless it was to exchange a few words with each other. Despite their extreme youth, they seemed to be several years younger than I was, they were among the most celebrated names in the Bombay film industry. Between them, they wrote the songs for Raj Kapoor's films, one of them being responsible for the music and the other for the lyrics. Some of their songs were very famous indeed, and had, in fact, contributed greatly to the success of the films for which they were written. Miss Nargis was, of course, Raj Kapoor's principal leading lady, and just as he was popularly known as the Clark Gable of India, so she, as Rashk told me, he being the source of my information about her, as of my information about Shankar and Jai Kishan, was popularly known as the Greta Garbo of India. Since my recollections of Marie Walewska were even vaguer than my recollections of Gone with the Wind, I had no means of telling to what extent the comparison was justified. But there was little doubt that, so far as outward appearance at least was concerned, Greta Garbo might have taken it as a compliment to be known as the Nargis of America. A few years younger than Raj Kapoor, and of medium height, Miss Nargis, the name meant Narcissus, had a clear brown complexion, a face elongated rather than round, a slightly prominent nose, and a pair of large dark eyes. Though her look was one of intelligence, it was also one of extraordinary sweetness and charm, while the unstudied grace of her movements were a delight to see. She invariably appeared floating in layer upon layer of starched white chiffon, wearing little or no jewellery, and with the corner of her sari drawn modestly over her head. So much white chiffon was there, indeed, that she seemed to move in a cloud, and I was sometimes apprehensive lest she should trip over it, or lest it should get in the way when she was pouring tea or handing round the cups. But she never tripped, and it never got in the way. It was as though she was surrounded by invisible sylphs, who bore up the edges of her draperies and prevented anything untoward from happening.
though she always followed our discussions with interest, she said hardly more than Shankar and Jai Kishan, seeming perfectly content to sit and listen and to serve tea. So quiet and so reserved was Miss Nargis, in fact, that when, towards the end of my stay in Bombay, Rashk wrote a scene that called for a violent emotional outburst on the part of the slave girl, or the beautiful princess, I could not help wondering whether such an outburst might not be beyond the Indian Greta Garbo's capacities. It was well within her capacities, Rashk assured me warmly. Nargis was a very great actress indeed. There was absolutely no comparison between her acting abilities and Raj Kapoor's. He could express only two different moods. She could express 40. On this occasion, as on others, I noticed that, besides having the greatest respect for Miss Nargis in her professional capacity, Rask was inclined to think of himself as her champion. Not that this was really very surprising. As he explained to me over a cup of tea one day, she confided in him quite a lot, especially when there were tensions in her relationship with Raj Kapoor or when she was having trouble with her family. Probably he knew as much about her as anybody did. She was a Muslim by birth, as I must have realised by her name, and supported not only her mother, but also her grown-up brothers, as well as a whole tribe of nieces and nephews. Though her brothers treated her very badly, even to the extent of beating her, she was extremely fond of her little nieces and nephews, and was always buying things for them. She spent hardly anything on herself, he added, though privately I reflected that at some time or other she must have invested in quite a large quantity of white chiffon. Be that as it may, she usually joined us at the coffee table only some time after our discussion had started, silently settling herself on the floor or on the settee beside Raj Kapoor with a smile of greeting for Rashk and myself. One day, however, I arrived to find her and Raj Kapoor bent over a tape recorder. Apart from the pocket model with which Nebesky had recorded the recitals of a Tibetan bard, this was the first time I had seen one, and Raj Kapoor lost no time in showing me how it worked. It was a birthday present from Nargis, he told me proudly, and had cost 2,000 rupees. Thereafter, the tape recorder was switched on for all our meetings, and I believe Raj Kapoor also used it to record the lengthy monologues in which he was in the habit of indulging when alone. Probably the most interesting of our tape-recorded discussions related not to Ajanta, but to a dream Raj Kapoor had had the night before. "What do you think I dreamt last night, Reverend?" he demanded of me one day as soon as I arrived. Of course, I did not know, whereupon he proceeded to tell me how Jesus and the Buddha had been to see him, how one had sat on his right knee and one on his left, and how the three of them had had a long conversation. From the way in which he told me this, I gathered that he took the dream to mean that Jesus and the Buddha had recognized him as their spiritual equal. This was not as surprising as it might seem. As I knew from my conversations with Rask, Raj Kapoor was famous as a maker of social films, a social film being a film with a social message, usually of a vaguely left-wing kind. In these films, he appeared in the role of a lovable and pathetic victim of social injustice, who, after being made to suffer in various ways, eventually turns the tables on his oppressors, and in the course of so doing, delivers impassioned speeches on behalf of the poor and downtrodden. Apparently his best-known scene was one in which, having pleaded not guilty to a charge of theft on the grounds that he was hungry, he proceeded to denounce the existing economic system at great length to a spellbound courtroom. Conveying the kind of message that they did, Raj Kapoor's films were extremely popular, not only in India, but also, it was said, in the Soviet Union. Thus, it was hardly surprising that he should regard his films as performing much the same function as the great religious teachers had performed of old, and himself, therefore, as being the spiritual equal of those teachers. Another of our tape-recorded conversations related to literature, "What do you think I read yesterday, Reverend?" he demanded of me on my arrival on this occasion. Again, I did not know, whereupon he told me that he had actually read a book. From this, I concluded that he was not a great reader, though later on Rusk told me that he did, in fact, read every day, but that he read only pornographic literature of the cheapest type. What he should really have said was that yesterday he had actually read a non-pornographic book. Those of our meetings that did not take place in Raj Kapoor's private quarters at RK Studios took place at his own residence, which, like the studios, was situated at Chembur. Here I met his wife, his younger brother, his small son, his father, and various other members of the family, all of whom, it seemed, had been involved, were now involved, or were going to be involved in the film industry. This was particularly true of his father, Prithviraj Kapoor, who had originally been a stage actor and, in fact, a leading figure in the movement for the revival of the Hindi theatre. With the virtual supersession of the stage by the screen, he had been forced to transfer his talents to the films and now generally took the part of king or demigod in the historical and mythological extravaganzas, which were, if anything, even more popular with the cinema-going Indian public than were the social films. Though not nearly so famous as his son, he was sufficiently well-known, and off the screen, at least, cut a far more impressive figure. Indeed, with his grizzled locks, regal bearing, sonorous voice, and carelessly draped chadar, Prithviraj Kapoor looked every inch an actor of the old school. I noticed also that when he spoke to Raj Kapoor, it was in a direct and authoritative, yet at the same time essentially friendly and familiar manner, which, I suspected, no one else could have adopted with him, certainly no one at RK Studios. Raj Kapoor, for his part, obviously stood very much in awe of his formidable parent, and in fact appeared quite diminished in his presence, the more especially since Prithviraj was the taller of the two by at least half a head. Seeing Raj Kapoor as often as I did, and having so many opportunities of observing him at close quarters, I naturally tried to form an overall estimate of the character of the man. This was by no means an easy thing to do. Not only was it sometimes difficult for me to tell when the famous film star was acting and when he was not, but as I eventually realised, he did not always know this himself. In other words, he did not always know whether the feelings to which he gave such eloquent and even impassioned utterance were really his own feelings or were merely assumed for the occasion. So much was this the case, indeed, that there were times when I wondered if it might not be said of actors, as Pope had said of women, that they were, quote, matter too soft, a lasting mark to bear, unquote, and that most of them had, therefore, quote, no characters at all, unquote. But this would have probably have been going a little too far. In Raj Kapoor's case, at least, the actor was also producer and director, and in this latter capacity, so Rask assured me, the Clark Gable of India was certainly not lacking in character. Intensely ambitious and of truly demonic energy, he demanded total loyalty from those who worked for him, in return for which he looked after them extremely well, so long as they remained working for him and showed no signs of wanting to leave for greener pastures elsewhere. If anyone actually did leave RK Films, he took it very much to heart and might even turn quite nasty, with unfortunate consequences for the offender. Raj Kapoor was, in fact, an extremely vindictive person, Rask added, besides being completely ruthless when it came to dealing with those who opposed him or who, whether intentionally or unintentionally, got in the way of his achieving his ambitions. In short, he was a dangerous man to tangle with, particularly as his popularity in the Soviet Union gave him entree into the highest government circles and enabled him to pull all kinds of strings. Altogether, it was a not very attractive picture, and one that I found difficult to reconcile with the impression I had formed of the film star in the course of our discussions. I was also left wondering whether Raj Kapoor, the actor, made use of Raj Kapoor, the producer and director, to achieve his purely artistic objectives, or whether Raj Kapoor, the producer and director, used Raj Kapoor, the actor, to further his own very different aims. In the end, I concluded that being, as he apparently was, both characterless and possessed of character, it was not really possible for me to form an overall estimate of Raj Kapoor without knowing him much better than I did, and that he was, in fact, a quite complex person. But if Raj Kapoor was a quite complex person, Arjun Dev Rashk, on the other hand, was a relatively simple one, and therefore much easier to get to know. Indeed, I had not been many days in Bombay before there sprang up between the swarthy young scriptwriter and myself a friendship that was to become quite independent of my connection with Ajanta. The main reason for this, apart from the fact that we happened to like each other, was a common interest in literature. As I soon learned, Rashk had started out as a poet, an Urdu poet. On discovering that there was, in his own words, no money in poetry, he had taken to writing scripts for Hindi films, an occupation he frankly regarded as a form of literary prostitution, and for the last 2 or 3 years had worked with Raj Kapoor, for whom he felt a strong but not uncritical admiration. An additional reason why friendship had sprung up between Rashk and myself was the fact that we spent a lot of time together. In Sanchi, Raj Kapoor had invited me to come to Bombay for a few days as the guest of RK Films, and even after my removal from the first-class hotel to Ananda Vihara, the guest of RK Films I most certainly was. Indeed, it was as though Rashk had not only been instructed to escort me to Bombay and book me into a hotel, but also instructed to keep me company and look after me for the whole of my stay in that city. It was Rashk who, nearly every day, collected me from the hotel, or after the first week, from Ananda Vihara, and drove me to RK Studios. It was Rashk who sat with me in restaurants and tea shops, discussing Buddhism, RK Films, Raj Kapoor, Nargis, the Bombay film industry, Indian politics, Mahatma Gandhi, sex, and the modern American novel. It was Rashk who accompanied me to the English bookshops in the Fort area and to the Prince of Wales Museum. It was Rashk who took me home with him to his flat in Carr to sample his wife's cooking. Finally, it was Rashk who, when I had been in Bombay for nearly 3 weeks, drove me all the way to Deolali for my second reunion with Lama Govinda and Lee Gotami. A few days before that, however, I had my first meeting with a man who, while hardly less known than Raj Kapoor, was in many ways his complete antithesis. This was Dr. B.R. Ambedkar, the great scheduled caste leader, to whom I had written in June 1950, expressing my appreciation of his article on, quote, the Buddha and the future of his religion, unquote, and telling him about the formation of the YMBA, and from whom I had received a friendly and encouraging reply. Since then, no communication had passed between us, neither had we met. Prior to my leaving Calcutta, I had indeed hopes that he would be in Sanchi for the re-enshrinement of the sacred relics, and that it would be possible for us to have a talk. But in the event, my hopes were dashed. The scheduled caste leader was not there. Quite possibly, he had not even been invited to take part in the celebrations. For though I did not know it at the time, he was at loggerheads with the government, and David Priyaji may well have thought that to have Ambedkar, who was nothing if not outspoken, occupying the same platform as Pandit Nehru and Dr. Radhakrishnan, would be to invite almost certain trouble. Be that as it may, I had not been much more than a week in Bombay when I came to know, probably from an item in the newspapers, that Ambedkar was in the city, and at once decided to go and see him. As the telephone directory, I think, informed me, he lived at Dada, a predominantly working-class district in the very heart of Bombay. And it was for Dada that, on a day when I had no meeting with Raj Kapoor, I accordingly set out. On my arrival at Rajgriha, the sizeable residence Ambedkar had built for himself 10 or 15 years earlier, I was shown into a large, rather sparsely furnished apartment that evidently served as both office and reception room. Here there were a number of people, including the 10 or 12 members of what appeared to be a deputation, the leaders of which nervously clasped between them an enormous marigold and tinsel garland. Having dealt with the deputation, which seemed to have incurred his displeasure in some way, the grim-faced, heavily built man in the loosely fitting Western-style suit took his place at the desk before which, on my arrival, he had caused me to be seated. Like Raj Kapoor, Ambedkar had a question, but unlike Raj Kapoor, he put it without preamble and without the slightest attempt at charm. "Why does your Mahabodhi Society have a Bengali Brahmin for its president?" he demanded belligerently. "It was not my Mahabodhi Society," I retorted. "I did what I could to help it, since it was the premier Buddhist organisation in India. But I was not actually a member of the society, and was no more happy that it should have a Bengali Brahmin for its president than he himself appeared to be." The Brahmin in question was Dr. Shyama Prasad Mukherjee, who, besides being the president of the Mahabodhi Society, was a former president of the Hindu Mahasabha, a right-wing caste Hindu organisation, and a leading opponent of Ambedkar's Hindu Code Bill. My explanation having satisfied the scheduled caste leader, it was not long before conversation turned to Buddhism. Probably with his article on the Buddha and the future of his religion in mind, I asked him whether he thought that Buddhism had a future in India. His answer to the question was an indirect one. "I have no future in India," he exclaimed bitterly, his face darkening with something akin to despair. The fact was that at the time of our meeting, Ambedkar's political career was more or less in ruins, and his formidable energies had yet to be fully focused, as subsequently they were, on the conversion of his millions of untouchable followers to Buddhism. It must have been one of the blackest periods of his life. I did not know this, of course, any more than I then realised the significance of our meeting, which was not only to be followed by further meetings, but which, 4 years later, resulted in my coming into close personal contact with tens of thousands of ex-untouchable Buddhists, a development that profoundly influenced the course of my life and work. Nonetheless, I was glad to have met Ambedkar, and glad I'd had the opportunity of making clear to him where I stood as regards the Mahabodhi Society and what I thought of that organisation's having a Bengali Brahmin for its president. But though I did not realise the significance of my meeting with Ambedkar, and indeed could not have realised it at the time, I was very much aware of the significance of my second reunion with Lama Govinda and Lee Gotami. Kindred spirits that we were, the week that I would be spending with them in their new home would have the effect of strengthening our tripartite friendship and further defining what it was in our attitude to Buddhism that united us to one another and divided us from such as Thun Hla Ung and the militant Theravadins of Ceylon. On our way out of Bombay, Rashk and I stopped off at Raj Kapoor's residence so that I could bid the Clark Gable of India farewell, after which it was not long before we were on the dusty, tree-lined highway and heading for Deolali as fast as bullock carts and vagrant curs would permit. It was a glorious day, all blue skies and sunshine. Despite the stifling heat of the car, I felt extremely happy, even jubilant. Behind me was a successful visit to Bombay, and now that it was over, I could look forward to what would, I hoped, be a still more successful visit to Deolali. Moreover, on my bidding him farewell, Raj Kapoor had not only thanked me in his most ingratiating manner for having helped with the planning of Ajanta, he had also handed me an envelope that proved to contain 5 crisp new 100 rupee notes. This meant that my immediate financial problems were solved and that I did not have to wonder how I was going to manage on my return to Kalimpong.
Barnes High School, Deolali, seemed to be situated miles from the cantonment, while the gate lodge itself, into which Lama Govinda and Lee Gotami had moved some months earlier, seemed to be situated miles from the school. A grey stone building, obviously dating from the time of the Raj, it straddled the road with what could only be described as an air of defiance. As Rask and I drew up in its shadow, 4 or 5 hours after leaving Chembur, a door at the foot of one of its flanking towers flew open, and Lama Govinda and Lee Gotami issued forth to greet us and lead us upstairs to the range of spacious rooms that they occupied immediately above the road. Rask was, I could see, a little taken aback by my two friends' colourful and exotic appearance, as it must have seemed to Indian eyes, and obviously did not quite know what to make of them at first, but so warm and friendly was their treatment of him that by the end of the meal, which, at their insistence, he stayed and shared, the swarthy young scriptwriter was very much prepossessed in their favour. Before he left, it was agreed between us that he should come and collect me in a week's time and drive me back to Bombay, whence I would make my way to Kalimpong. As soon as he had gone, my hosts and I took up the thread of the talk we had been obliged to cut short in Sanchi, and before long we were deep in conversation. It was a discussion that not only lasted far into the night, but continued during the days that followed, almost without interruption. The only real interruptions, in fact, were when either Lama Govinda or Lee Gotami had to go and take a class at Barnes High School. As in Kalimpong and Goom, we ranged over practically the whole field of Buddhist life and thought, with particular reference to the relation between Buddhism and spiritual life, on the one hand, and literature and the fine arts, on the other. But though we ranged so widely, there was one topic to which both Lama Govinda and Lee Gotami came back again and again, and which they both seemed, in fact, to have very much in mind. This was the topic of the Tsaparang expedition, the journey they had made in 1948-49 to the ruined temples of the former capital of Western Tibet. During the week that he and Lee Gotami had spent with me in Kalimpong, Lama Govinda had, of course, given a talk on the Tsaparang expedition, a talk he had illustrated by showing a number of his own paintings and sketches, many of them executed on the spot. Lee Gotami, for her part, had shown the tracings she had made of frescoes depicting the life of the Buddha, tracings from which she hoped to produce copies of the frescoes, while Lama Govinda had given a running commentary on the different episodes in the Buddha's career that the frescoes depicted. Lee herself had given neither talk nor commentary, being apparently averse to speaking in public, but she now made up for this by giving me her account of the Tsaparang expedition, dwelling in characteristically lively and entertaining fashion on the difficulties at which Govinda had only hinted or of which he had made no mention, difficulties at which, in retrospect, both she and he could laugh, but which had been very serious at the time. One of their biggest difficulties, I gathered, was that of dealing with sullen, uncooperative porters and drunken, unreliable guides. The task of dealing with them had increasingly devolved upon Lee herself, who spoke fluent, bizarre Hindi, and who, in the course of the journey, managed to pick up enough colloquial Tibetan for practical purposes. Enough, that is, to give orders and bestow abuse. Lama Govinda's Hindi was rudimentary, despite his long residence in India, and though he could read Tibetan religious texts, he was unable to speak the language, as Dawa, in fact, had discovered in Kalimpong.
After hearing Lee's vivid description of how, week after week, she had struggled with the logistics of the expedition, supervising the loading and unloading of mules and yaks, and organising the crossing of rivers, I could not forbear asking, "But what did Lama Govinda do?" "Oh, he did the cooking," she replied, shrieking with laughter at the recollection, as the Lama himself smiled. The reply did not surprise me. I had already noticed that at Deolali itself, it was Govinda who did the cooking, while Lee made the beds and swept the floor. He was quite a good cook, though, as he explained to me one morning, he never spent more than half an hour on the actual preparation of a meal. Having chopped his vegetables and washed his rice and lentils, he popped them into the steam cooker and left them to boil while he carried on writing or painting. Long practice had, he assured me, enabled him to calculate exactly how much time was needed to cook a particular meal, so that lunch or dinner was always ready precisely when he and Lee wanted to have it. As he explained all this to me, and indeed showed me just how he distributed the vegetables, rice and lentils among the aluminium containers, and how he got the charcoal fire going in the little burner, I was reminded of those two solitary weeks at the Raipur ashram when I myself had cooked with the help of a patent steam cooker, weeks during which my two friends were seeking permission to enter Western Tibet. Lee Gotami, by her own laughing admission, knew next to nothing about cooking. The Parsi family into which she had been born was a wealthy one. She had grown up surrounded by servants, and until her marriage to Lama Govinda, she had had to make hardly so much as a cup of tea herself. There had been a previous marriage to a prominent Bombay lawyer and art critic, but of this she made no mention, either then or at any other time, and I learned about it only years later, after coming to know one of her petted cousins. Thus it was Govinda who did the cooking, and Lee who made the beds and swept the floor. In their relationship, there was indeed a certain reversal of the usual roles, with Lee sometimes taking the more active masculine role, and Govinda the more passive feminine one. This may well have had something to do with the fact that Lee was 20 years younger than her husband, whose student she had once been, and was possessed of an abundance of natural vigour. Whatever the explanation, there seemed to be little doubt that, on the mundane level at least, she had been the principal driving force behind the Taparang expedition, and that without her to cajole and bully on his behalf, the gentle, retiring Lama would never have seen Lake Manasarovar and Mount Kailas, never have seen the Valley of the Moon Castle, never have seen the frescoes of Toling and Saparang, and in all probability would never have written his book, The Way of the White Clouds. But often as Lee might take the masculine role, she was by no means devoid of feminine qualities. On the Saparang expedition itself, there had been occasions when these were very much in evidence. Some of the frescoes of which she wanted to make tracings were situated high up on the wall, just below the ceiling. In order to get at them, she had to sit perched on a pile of stones that she and Lama Govinda dismantled and rebuilt at a slightly different spot each morning. It was bitterly cold. One day, Govinda recalled, he had looked up from his own work to see that Lee was so cold and miserable that she was crying and that her tears were actually freezing before they had time to reach the ground. Such was the vividness of his description that in my mind's eye I could see the unhappy Lee perched aloft on her pile of stones like some latter-day female stylites and weeping diamonds. Lee laughed as Govinda told the story, but I noticed that there were tears in her eyes, as if she was re-experiencing, rather than just recollecting, the tribulations she had had to undergo in order to make her tracings. "Oh yes," she exclaimed, dashing a stray drop of moisture from her cheek. Her tears really had frozen. But that was not the worst of it. The Chinese ink she had been using to make the tracings had also frozen, and she had had to keep warming the tip of her brush with her breath. In view of the enormous effort that had gone into the making of them, as well as on account of their intrinsic value to lovers of Buddhist art, it was not surprising that Li should be quite protective towards her tracings, as I had indeed observed in Kalimpong. She was even more protective towards the copies of the original frescoes on which she had been working for the last year or more, but especially after Lama Govinda and herself had settled in Diolali. Only one of these copies was actually finished, though there were two others on which she was working, and when I had been with them for 2 days or 3 days, Govinda prevailed upon her to show it to me, which, with many protestations of its inadequacy, she eventually did. Approximately 3 feet by 2, which were the dimensions of the original fresco panel, it depicted the Buddha's victory over the hosts of Mara, immediately prior to his attainment of supreme enlightenment, and was remarkable for both richness of colour and delicacy of detail. As Govinda explained, the art of Zaparang could be regarded as constituting a distinct stage in the evolution of Buddhist art, a stage that was intermediate between the latest frescoes of Ajanta and the earliest frescoes and painted scrolls of Tibet proper. The discovery of Zaparang had, in fact, made possible the writing of a missing chapter in the history of Buddhist art, and its importance could hardly be overestimated. Li, having showed me her first finished fresco copy and received my warm congratulations on what she had done so far, and my strong encouragement to produce copies of all the frescoes of which she had made tracings, in the event she succeeded in producing only 3 altogether, it was Govinda's turn to show me the originals of what he called his cosmic abstracts, or meditation pictures. I was already familiar with these, having seen reproductions of at least some of them in his little book on art and meditation, afterwards incorporated into his book called Creative Meditation and Multidimensional Consciousness. But no reproduction could do justice to the glowing hues of the colour drawings he now carefully drew out from beneath their sheets of protective tissue paper. They were executed in oil pastels, a medium with which I was then unacquainted, but which seemed to be a favourite one with Govinda. I must have commented on the fact, for he proceeded to explain how simple and easy oil pastels were to use, and how convenient they were when one had no permanent studio and was forever on the move. Moreover, with oil pastels it was possible to obtain effects that could not be obtained with either oil paints or watercolours. Unfortunately, they were effects which could not be reproduced by any mechanical means. None of the printers he had dealt with had been able to achieve more than an approximation of the colour values of his cosmic abstracts and other oil pastel drawings. Some had been unable to achieve even an approximation. Talk about printers must have led to talk about publishers, and talk about publishers must in its turn have led to talk about editors, especially magazine editors. For Lama Govinda proceeded to tell me about an unpleasant interview which he and Li had recently had in Bombay with the editor of the Illustrated Weekly of India. As I already knew, it was the Illustrated Weekly of India that had sponsored the Zaparang expedition, and they had agreed to sponsor it because, as Lama Govinda had explained to Mr. Mandi at the time, the long-deserted temples of Western Tibet were unknown to modern scholarship, so that in visiting Zaparang and documenting its artistic treasures, he and Li Gotami would be doing something that had not been done before. They would, in effect, be discovering Zaparang, discovering it for Renaissance India and for the world. Shortly before our reunion in Sanchi, however, Mr. Mandi had summoned them to his office and virtually accused Lama Govinda of having misled him and obtained the sponsorship of the Illustrated on false pretences. The temples of Western Tibet had not been unknown to modern scholarship, and he and Li Gotami had not done something that had not been done before. They had not discovered Zaparang. Professor Tucci of Rome had discovered it. Professor Tucci, as he had recently learned, had led an expedition to Zaparang a decade or more before they had done.
He had visited the very temples that they had visited, had photographed the images and frescoes there, and had published the results of his researches in a book. The news and the accusation had shocked and distressed Govinda, and as I could see from the way he spoke of the matter, distressed him still. It had not been difficult to convince Mandy that he had not intended to mislead him, and that, strange as it might seem, he had been completely unaware of the fact of Twitchy's having visited Saparang. But it distressed him to think that he had misled him even unintentionally. Moreover, it had not been possible to convince Mandy that he had not intended to mislead him without admitting that he was less than well informed in a field in which he had represented himself as being an authority. In order to salvage his credibility as a man, he had had to sacrifice his reputation as a scholar. This too had distressed him, and distressed him still. But he was also puzzled. How could he not have known that Twitchy had visited Saparang? He exclaimed, with more feeling than I had yet seen him exhibit. He simply could not understand it. He could only assume that, owing to his reclusive existence, not to mention his internment, he had, over the years, become cut off from the international scholarly community to a greater extent than he had realised, and that much was happening in the way of exploration and publication, of which he had no knowledge. Naturally, I sympathised with Govinda. I sympathised with his distress at Mandy's accusation, and at the harm that had been done, not permanently, I hoped, to his scholarly reputation. I also understood his puzzlement and sympathised with the predicament in which he found himself. The predicament of the artist scholar who wished to live as a recluse, but who at the same time wanted to know what was happening in the world, at least within the sphere of his own special interests. His predicament was, in a way, my own. Living in Kalimpong as I did, I had cut myself off from the various cultural and religious movements then in progress in Western Europe, movements with which, had I returned to Britain after the war, instead of becoming a homeless wanderer in India, I might well have become involved. I had even cut myself off from the nascent British Buddhist movement. But I had no regrets, any more than Govinda really had. A reclusive existence, whether in Diolali or in Kalimpong, might indeed have its disadvantages, but the German artist-scholar and the English poet-monk were agreed that those disadvantages were far outweighed by the advantages. Lee Gotami must have been out when Lama Govinda told me about their interview with the editor of the Illustrated Weekly of India. She must have been out either teaching at the Barnes High School or shopping in the Cantonment Bazaar, because Govinda was able to tell me about the interview without being interrupted. When the three of us had been together in Kalimpong and Goom and in Sanchi, the lively, pugnacious little Parsi woman must have been on her best behaviour, so to speak, for as far as I could remember, she had never interrupted her husband while he was talking. In Diolali, it was quite another matter. Probably because she now knew me better and felt less inhibited by my presence, she interrupted and contradicted the poor Lama incessantly, this apparently being her normal way of relating to him. If he happened to recall how they had gone somewhere or seen somebody on a Thursday, she would be sure to interrupt him in mid-sentence with, "No, it was on a Wednesday. I'm sure it was on a Wednesday." "No, darling," he would reply, sometimes raising his hand in mild remonstrance. "It was on a Thursday. It must have been on a Thursday, because..." And he would proceed to remind her that the visit or meeting in question had taken place under such and such circumstances, and that the circumstances being as they were, it must have taken place on a Thursday, and could not possibly have taken place on a Wednesday. Sometimes it took Govinda several minutes to convince his argumentative helpmeet that he was right and she was wrong, as was invariably the case. Once he had convinced her, she would relapse into silence and he would resume his discourse until the next interruption.
Lee seemed not to mind being continually proved wrong in this way. For his part, Lama Govinda seemed not to mind her constant interruptions, and corrected her with his usual combination of firmness and gentleness. I noticed, though, that on such occasions he invariably addressed her as darling, as if this was the nearest he could get to expressing his irritation. I also noticed, as I think I had noticed in Kalimpong, that Lee usually addressed him as what sounded like Ken. What did this mean? Was Ken the diminutive of Kenneth? In which case, by what freak of feminine fancy had Lee chosen so to denominate her spouse? Or perhaps it was not Ken, but Ken, K-H-E-N. Kenpo being the Tibetan word for abbot, though in that case Govinda would have been abbot of a very small cenobium indeed, consisting of himself and Lee and the gate lodge cat. However, I did not think it proper to ask Lee why she addressed Govinda as Ken, either then or at any of my subsequent meetings with them. It was, perhaps, a delicate question, of the kind with which I was so familiar in Kalimpong, and the mystery remained unresolved. Whatever mystery there may have been about the way in which Lee Gotami addressed Lama Govinda, there was no mystery about the way in which she addressed me. She addressed me simply as Ratchika, or Ratchika Ji. Govinda never permitted himself to shorten my monastic name in this manner, either then or afterwards. Like the freedom with which she now interrupted her husband in my presence, her addressing me as Ratchika was no doubt due to the fact that she now knew me better. Since she knew me better, she could speak more freely, and since she could speak more freely, it was not surprising that one afternoon, when she was perhaps tired of the doctrinal discussions in which Govinda and I tended to become involved, she should have started talking about her school days in England. She had been educated at Rodine, the well-known public school for girls near Brighton, and had enjoyed her time there immensely. Indeed, from what she said, it was clear that the young Lee Gotami must have been a jolly hockey sticks sort of girl and extremely popular. Before her arrival, she related with hoots of laughter, the other girls had been told that a little Indian princess was coming to study with them. Though Lee came from a wealthy family and had an uncle who had been knighted, she was certainly not a princess, and the girls had been quite disappointed. Nonetheless, they made a great fuss of her, and she soon felt at home among them. Having been educated at Rodine, Lee was in some ways quite westernised, even anglicised. Govinda, on the other hand, after 20 years of study and teaching at Shantiniketan and Sarnath, Patna and Goom, was quite orientalised, even Indianised, though not so much in his personal habits as in respect of his philosophical outlook and religious beliefs. As for myself, I had spent only 6 years in India, two of them as a wandering ascetic, but I was already quite Indianised, in some ways perhaps to a greater extent than Govinda. Thus, each of us represented a combination, in various proportions, of the Eastern and the Western, India and Europe. Each of us had created, was in process of creating, his or her personal synthesis of modern culture and ancient spiritual tradition. As such, we had a great deal in common, even apart from our allegiance to Buddhism. It was therefore not surprising that the week I spent with Lama Govinda and Lee Gotami in Deolali should have passed quickly, at least for me, and that by the time Rashk came to collect me, I should have felt that our tripartite friendship was stronger than ever. End of chapter 20.